and a very warm welcome to this week's Guardian Tech Weekly. Like a hopelessly premature firework, we'll be lighting the blue touch paper and standing well back as we enjoy a stunning display of the latest news, views and reviews from the world of technology. My name's Susie Weezer and I'm joined this week by the statesman of cynicism, Charles Arthur, and the nation's favourite pipe smoker, Jack Schofield. Now, Charles, your favourite firework?
Any of the ones that don't fly off and hit you in the face.
And Jack, your firework of choice?
Roman candles, I suppose.
I'll be ensuring you stand far enough away from the bonfire of news in your flammable clothing, as well as ensuring you dispose of your sparkler of technological analysis in the proper fashion. Enough of that analogy? Yeah, then on with the show. You can't fail to have noticed that last week saw the launch of Windows 7, Microsoft's latest operating system. It surpassed both Harry Potter and any Dan Brown offering to become the biggest grossing pre-ordered product in Amazon's history, and demand was such that several high street stores opened at midnight to satisfy their customers' need for new. However, to many, the biggest challenge Microsoft faced with this was to undo the harm the previous version, Vista, had inflicted on its reputation, and to re-establish Microsoft as the dominating operating system in the ever-changing landscape, which now counts both Apple and Google as very serious competitors.
My name is Roger. I'm a PC.
I'm a PC.
I'm a PC.
Yeah. I'm a PC too. I'm a PC and a human being. Not a human doing, not a human thinking. A human being.
I'm a PC and I sell fish.
One way they've found for addressing this has been to make it, if not future-proof, at least future-compatible, making sure it will work seamlessly with the new generation of wholly touchscreen devices. Up until now, they've favoured XP over Vista, if not their very own operating system. And if you've seen the adverts, you'll know they've also added several new features to make it easier to work with than Vista. But in order to understand where Microsoft are now, we need to take a look at where they've come from. Tech Weekly spoke to Lawrence Pennell, a Windows 7 UK product manager, Nick McGrath, Director of Commercial Market Strategy in the UK, and Julie Larson-Green, Vice President of Windows Experience.
My name is Nick McGrath, and I've been with Microsoft now for 17 and a half years. It's always been called Windows, but if you put a copy of Windows version 1 next to a copy of Windows 7... you'd certainly see the evolution. I think the hardest thing you'd find is actually finding a computer that could run it. In Windows 1, you're talking about 16-bit computing, either a black and white screen, or you may have even been fortunate to have a green and a slightly light green screen. Some people had brown and orange. And that environment just did not meet consumers' needs or businesses' needs. Most applications themselves were developed in isolation. You had a very specific application which was written in a very bespoke way using a very bespoke development language. And this was a program which we brought out which sat on top of MS-DOS. And in essence, it took people away from the command user interface and it would introduce them to a graphical user interface. And it was an environment that inherently had two problems. The first of those was flexibility, being able to deliver to the user what they expected, either in the business space or the home space. And the second one was very much around ease of use. And it was really across those two different dynamics that we started off on the journey of Windows.
Here's Steve Ballmer, launching Windows 1 in 1985.
How much do you think this advanced operating environment is worth? Wait just 1 minute before you answer. Now we can take this Ferrari and paste it right into Windows Write. Now how much do you think Microsoft Windows is worth? Don't answer. Wait until you see Windows Write and Windows Paint all for just $99. That's right. It's $99. It's an incredible value, but it's true. It's Windows from Microsoft. Order today.
We introduced this amazing concept to the world. It was called the GUI, the graphical user interface. Yes, there are many organizations in the world that have built, windowing style technologies. The GEM technology was one, certainly Apple with their first, the Macs that came out, the Unix environment and some of the graphical workstations that were built on technologies like Solaris and so on and so forth. I think that there is only one version, there is only one Windows. We quickly evolved that. In 1987, we brought out Windows 2.0, And Windows 2.0 took the basis of Windows 1 and it built on top of it by introducing a thing called DDE, or Dynamic Data Exchange. Now, what that gave was the ability for one application to automatically talk to another application, which hitherto had not been simple or easy to actually achieve. The example here being the ability to have overlapping screens or windows. We also introduced a software development kit, which meant that for third parties, people writing software and writing software for hardware for things like device drivers, there was a single development kit that gave them the ability to be able to really get the most value out of Windows. And it was really this basis that then we saw the entire independent software vendor community grow up around Windows, and which has exploded to where it is today.
That was the sound that launched Windows 3 for millions more users as the next version of the system was launched in 1990. It brought with it icon groupings and important developments like the file and print managers. But as Windows became installed on many more computers, Microsoft then had to tackle the problem of how to get inexperienced users comfortable with using their machines.
One of the biggest issues we had was teaching people how to use the mouse. And that's where there was a product called Solitaire. It's one of the world's most exceptionally widely tested beta programs in the entire planet. I can absolutely guarantee you that there are no bugs in that product. It's been extensively tested by millions of people over the years. There is a serious side to why we built Solitaire. It actually uses every single mouse function that you can possibly do, without the exclusion, obviously, of the right mouse click. That's about the only one that you can do. So you click on a card to drag it and drop it. You double-click on it to move it from the bottom of the deck up onto the discard pile. You have pull-downs for menus. That was the reason why we built Solitaire.
The next milestone was a launch which departed from the architecture that had been present in previous versions and set out a pathway for the future, Windows NT.
This was built by a gentleman called David Cutler, who we brought over from Digital. Windows NT stood for New Technology. And the reason why we built NT was very much with the business customer in mind. But it was a ground-up operating system that was built without some of the incumbencies of MS-DOS. So it looked and felt the same, but the underlying heart of the machine, the kernel of the operating system, if you will, was significantly better from a security point of view, a reliability point of view, and a stability perspective.
The end of the 90s and the turn of the millennium saw a succession of updates to the OS. Windows 95 introduced the start button to the interface, as well as plug-and-play compatibility when adding hardware. Windows 98, Windows 2000, and Windows ME all followed, until in 2001, Windows XP was released.
Windows XP stands for experience, and that is because this was when we effectively retired the Windows 9X or the MS-DOS versions of the Windows tree, and now the future lay on top of the NT kernel. Primary benefits behind the Windows XP product was around reliability and security. And I think that's one of the main reasons why people have looked at Windows XP and thought, yes, this is delivering what I need and it's providing me with the functionality I need.
My name's Lawrence Paynell. I'm a Windows 7 product manager here in the UK. We recognized that the XP product wasn't going to be the platform that we wanted to move forward with from a security perspective. We understood the challenges that we had there, and we had to make some significant changes to the Windows platform in order to make it more secure and give us a foundation that we would be prepared to move forward with in the future. Windows Vista very much provided that foundation, but we understood that the changes that we'd introduced in Windows Vista would cause challenges, especially around application and device compatibility, because we changed some of the models that were provided in XP fundamentally to give a more secure platform. Because XP was around for so long, estimations were anywhere between 70 and 80% of the user install base when we released Windows Vista were actually running Windows XP. So that meant that anybody could look around, they could go to somebody and say, I don't understand what's happening here, and they had somebody there that understood what was happening and could provide them the support and give them guidance on how to use the product.
Hello, I'm a PC, and I've been made into a stereotype.
I'm a PC.
I wear jeans.
And I study jeans.
And I design jeans.
And I design green buildings.
I'm a PC, and I study the law.
And I practice the law.
And I challenge the law.
I'm a PC, and I blog for Obama.
And I broadcast for McCain. And I have a beard.
With the advent of Surface Pack 1, which came out just over a year after the release of Windows Vista, we'd really addressed a lot of the compatibility issues. We gathered a lot of feedback in market from customers. We listened to what was said, and obviously we tried to address as much of that as possible. On the business side of things, we understood that maybe we didn't do as good a job as we could have done with Vista in that space. And we learned a lot, and we've made sure that with Windows 7, that we've really changed the way in which we approach our audience. We made it available to everybody worldwide in the beta at the beginning of this year. And we also released a release candidate to everybody. So we've had 8 million testers worldwide of Windows 7. And we really picked up on the feedback that we gathered from Windows Vista.
Julie Larson-Green was instrumental in creating the version of Windows that was going to follow Vista, Windows 7. She's the Vice President of Windows Experience and oversaw the program managers who wrote the specifications for Windows 7, as well as the designers and researchers.
I joined the team in July 2006, and right away we started thinking about what we wanted to do for the next release, although Windows Vista wasn't out the door yet. So I had time to learn about the team and learn about the challenges with the product, or also the challenges in the marketplace and what customers were looking for out of Windows. I kind of developed some hypothesis about what we should do, and we started looking at deeply into customer research. We have over 1 billion customers with Windows, so you can imagine that there's a lot of conflicting information about what you should do and what you shouldn't do. And so we worked hard to understand the full scenarios that people were trying to get done and then trying to make those much easier. So one of those things was how long it takes to get back to a document you were working on the day before. And so that led to the invention of jump lists on the taskbar. So now instead of going to the start menu, starting the program, going to the file menu, finding the document, you just right-click on the icon on the taskbar, and the documents that you are using are all right there. And so it reduces quite a number of steps and makes people more efficient.
My name's Sam, and today I'm going to be taking pictures of the land of robots.
There's lots of brainstorming, there's lots of data collection, and we have statisticians that look for statistical significance on trends and things like that. But we also do a lot of creative, you know, drawing on paper, putting it in front of customers very early before we've even started any code. One of the things that we do is kind of have principles, come up with a set of principles of how we want the product to feel. And so one of the principles that we had in Windows 7 was to have you feel like you were in control, and that the computer was performing a service for you and was being a helpful friend or butler to get you to what you wanted to do, rather than trying to tell you, being the annoying friend saying, there's new Defender definitions to download, or there's this or there's that coming out of the notification tray. So you have a series of those things, and then we take it back to customers and double-check that we were on the right track.
I'm a PC, and I am 7 years old.
The new Snap feature is something that appears to be a relatively small and simple new feature in this version of Windows, but actually involved quite a bit of work.
Being able to put two documents side by side, snap them to the edges of the screen, seems very straightforward. We knew the number of documents that people, from our data, the number of documents people tend to have on the screen. But when you get into it, there's all of the, how close does it get to the side of the screen before it snaps? How can you reduce the amount of accidental snapping? What are the different ways we're going to help people snap? Should there be keyboard access for snapping? And we had a lot of trial and error around both the location of the mouse to the edge of the screen, having an outline where it shows you a little bit before you actually do it that it's going to happen. And those were all things we had to refine over time by getting feedback to people until it felt, you know, to most folks, that it's pretty natural and it just does what you think it's going to do and no surprises.
Though it's unlikely that Windows 7 will have a lifespan as long as XP's 6 years, it's likely to see significant developments in how we interact with our machines, notably the introduction of touchscreen capabilities to the PC. Microsoft has built this capability into Windows 7, but how were they able to plan and prepare for this when they were building the operating system years before the release date, which itself is years before the introduction of the technology?
One of the fun things about working on Windows is you have a vast ecosystem of hardware developers and software developers that you can work with to come up with ideas and things that are happening and kind of help start a trend. And so touch computing is something that we feel we started with Windows 7. We worked closely with the Microsoft Surface team, which had built the Surface Table with a lot of touch interface, and we picked up a lot of cues from that. Then we worked with several different screen manufacturers and several of the OEMs. To start the trend, you have to be a good example of the trend. So you know, Windows itself has to be a good use of your finger and that you can use or multiple fingers to manipulate the user experience. And so we did a lot of work there. We also worked very closely with the Windows Live team to touch enable things like Photo Gallery and things like that. But we also get surprised by what people bring back to you. So we worked with a company called Autodesk, and they have had some really interesting CAD software that they've built where you can extrude the actual item by dragging your fingers out and it redraws everything. Corel has done things in their applications as well, and so it's really fun to see how it sparks the imagination of how you can interact with the computer and the new things that you can do.
So now that Windows 7 is out the door, the planning starts for the next version. But what does the future hold for Windows? Will operating systems be as important when an increasing number of tasks are moving into the cloud? Julie Larson-Green has the last word on that in a minute, but first, Nick McGrath again on the prospects for Windows.
If I look at the future of Windows, it's about three screens in the cloud. We have Windows phones now, and the latest version of Windows on the phone has just released a laptop screen or a desktop screen, as well as on a television screen when it comes to the media center. And we will support all of that using cloud-based services.
I never understand when people say, I want just a browser, because the data shows that is not the case. In a six-month period on the beta, we had over 800,000 unique applications used by our customers that were on the beta. So there's still a reason, many reasons, to want to connect to or run a PC operating system. Of course, you need a PC operating system to run a browser on and connect devices to it and print and things like that. So I don't see a world where the operating system becomes less important anytime soon.
That was Lawrence Pennell, Nick McGraw and Julie Larson-Green from Microsoft. Now, Jack, you've had a chance to play with the product. Just briefly, what are your initial thoughts on it?
Well, the initial impression is how much it looks like Vista, which I think is the thing I'm not supposed to say. It's rather smooth, rather powerful, rather nice. I think Michael Dell said it would make you love your computer again, and I don't love my computer, but I understand what he means. It's a much more engaging operating system, and I think it probably will be much more successful than Vista, although, of course, that depends on how many people buy it.
Absolutely. Is it the kind of product that you'd recommend people go and purchase immediately, or should they be waiting until they upgrade their PC when it's likely to come bundled?
Well, I think most people only upgrade to a new version of Windows when they buy a new PC. That's historically always been true. I don't see any particular reason to change that now. I mean, there are people who are early adopters, who are enthusiasts, who have probably already run out and bought it, and that's fine. I mean, there's nothing to stop people from buying it. But Windows XP is going to be around for a very long time. There are more than a billion Windows users out there. So for the foreseeable future, most of those are still going to be on XP. On the other hand, XP is clearly going to go away. It's clearly doomed. And so, you know, might as well face the fact that you're going to move at some point and do it at the most convenient time. That might be now, it might be in 2 years' time, but that's entirely up to the person who's using the computer.
Okay, so aside from what's available in terms of Microsoft on the market at the moment, how does it stack up against what else is available? Apple have recently launched Snow Leopards. There's an Ubuntu update coming this week. Charles, can Windows 7 compete?
First of all, I just want to go back to the point that might have had a lot of people sort of jumping out of their seat, where the guy said, we introduced people to the graphical interface. Not true. I'm sorry. You know, Apple did that. Gem was doing that. Digital Research, I think, was the name.
There's an early one, which was Vision.
Yeah, there was tons of GUIs. I think for anyone in Microsoft to be claiming that they invented the GUI or introduced people to the GUI,
Hold on, Charles. People who were geeky and in the industry obviously knew graphical user interfaces, And no way did Microsoft invent or get them to market first. But if you go on to 1990, Windows 3.1 was the first mass market graphical user interface, you know, in terms of volume shipping. And so it's kind of reasonable to say that they did introduce, you know, the man in the street.
It's just one of those little things of sort of ignoring everything else that's around, which is easily done, but which I think sort of contains the seeds of a sort of downfall. Microsoft is so big now that it's at risk of simply becoming really sclerotic, and the whole way that Windows 7 is being thought about and presented is indicative of how big it's got. I've just been looking at the quarterly results, which they announced on Friday after, of course, the Vista launch. Sorry, not the Vista launch, the Windows 7 launch. It's really interesting because looking at the sectors, there's a fall in revenues and in profits for pretty much all of the sectors. There's a fall in revenues for the Windows and Windows Live of nearly $2 billion. And there's a fall in profits of nearly the same sort of, well, $1.5 billion. These are big numbers that they're losing here. And I think that Microsoft is going to have to face, well, I'm not sure if it can face the fact, actually, but other people perhaps are going to realize that it's become so big. And as you say, even if Windows 7 is the most incredibly successful product, it's not going to displace XP. And actually, I think there's a question of, well, where are people going to go? Are they really going to go up to Windows 7, or are they going to start looking around and just get a little netbook? And actually, will they find that the problems of intrusion and viruses and Trojans and so on mean that Ubuntu can actually get some sort of hold?
Well, I think they are going to go to Windows 7 or Windows 8 because XP is not going to survive in the next 5 years. And, you know, the fact is that Microsoft does do a better job of producing a mass market operating system than anybody else. More polish, more depth, more applications, easier to use. And it has roughly 96% of the market. That 96% of the market isn't going to go away. Anybody who's bothered about viruses can upgrade to Windows 7, will find themselves more secure. And because it's still Windows underneath, the amount of relearning they have to do and the ease of upgrade, including, you know, getting the applications to work, is much lower than it is with any other system. And on the grounds of the line of least resistance, I see, you know, Windows continuing for the foreseeable future.
Since Microsoft's last launch, we've seen a massive rise in cloud computing, and specifically Google are now beginning to talk about their Chrome OS, which moves away from basically puts the user's workspace onto the internet. Now, Charles, given that Google's a pioneers in this area, can Microsoft sufficiently catch up to make Windows a true player in cloud computing?
That's difficult because its entire DNA is built around people having computers which are storing things locally. It's not built into the DNA that when you log in that everything's about having stuff elsewhere. I mean, you can say much the same actually about, you know, the way that Apple's OS is designed. I think it's interesting that, for example, in the last few weeks, we've heard of big contract wins for Google. There's Rentokil, for example, which is taking 35,000 seats, as they're called, and it's going to be going with Google apps for those. I mean, The Guardian, in fact, has gone away from using Microsoft Office, now uses OpenOffice and Google apps as well. Capgemini has also gone with Google apps for certain of its uses. I think there's going to be more of these cases. I think that there's quite a challenge coming from Google here, and it's quite hard for Microsoft to react to it, because if you look at the numbers, again, for its recent financials, its online division actually made a loss of $480 million on revenues of $490 million. So basically, for every dollar it was getting in, it was paying out two. So it doesn't seem to quite have the hang of it yet.
Mm. Jack, what's your opinion on this? Can Microsoft catch up with Google?
I think it's a very complicated situation. On the financial results, one of the reasons that the Windows revenue is down is that there's $1.5 billion of deferred revenues from, you know, giving people free copies of Windows 7 when they buy Vista. Yeah, you're certainly going to see those figures rebound. When it comes to the cloud, Microsoft is heavily investing in the cloud, so I think it's much too soon to decide which way that's going to go, especially since Microsoft's Azure cloud-based system will ultimately enable people to move Windows applications to the cloud. But I'm not actually terribly sold on cloud computing personally. Giving somebody else your data is not my idea of a wise move from the point of view of protecting yourself.
Yeah, well, a controversial subject we're going to have to have a whole new show on, I think, by the sounds of it. Believe it or not, there's been more going on than just the launch of Windows 7. Here's a roundup of the tech news headlines.
Orange will start selling the iPhone to British customers in just over 2 weeks, triggering a two-horse race for customers in the run-up to Christmas. Orange is understood to be planning to launch the iPhone on the 10th of November, the day after O2's two-year exclusive contract with Apple comes to an end. It'll be sold through the company's own shops and Phones for You. And staying with mobile news, Nokia, the world's largest mobile phone manufacturer, has launched a legal attack on Apple in the US courts. The Finnish company alleges that the iPhone infringes 10 of its patents. The case, however, is unlikely to come to court until the end of 2011, allowing Apple to continue to develop and ship the iPhone, which has rapidly eaten into Nokia's share of the lucrative smartphone market since its launch in 2007. The Guardian has emailed up to 500,000 users of its UK-based jobs website to tell them that some of their personal data may have been compromised by a sophisticated and deliberate hack. There's no need for site users to change their passwords, but the compromised data could include names, email addresses, covering letters, and CVs. The Guardian said they had no reason to believe that any financial or bank data was compromised. And the American bookstore Barnes & Noble are to join Amazon in releasing their own branded e-book reader. The Android-based Nuke, as it's called, includes Wi-Fi, 3G, a colour screen to complement the e-ink display, and a service which allows you to pick up reading from where you left off on a free BlackBerry or iPhone app. Also announced this week was Amazon's e-book software for the PC, which will allow you to access content from the Kindle on your desktop.
We mentioned there O2 losing the exclusivity of the iPhone, with Orange first to get their hands on it on November the 10th. Jack, with pricing as yet unannounced, do you think they'll be able to undercut O2?
I really have no idea at all. It seems to me that there should be more attention paid to, you know, like quality of the network service and customer service and things like that, rather than the price of the product.
Sure. Yeah, O2 network service, not something they're becoming renowned for at the moment. Charles, what's your opinion? Can Orange undercut?
Orange hasn't always done great deals. They're not known for their data deals, for example. I think Three has been rather better on that front. So it will be very interesting to see whether the iPhone comes with an unlimited contract as it has on O2. I think if it doesn't, then a lot of people are not going to bother with it. If it does, then the question of the price becomes really keen, because Orange might see a lot of its own customers moving to an iPhone if the price isn't competitive with O2. But if it's undercutting, then I think it'll see people moving in hordes.
Absolutely, it could be big Christmas news. And what about this Nokia patent battle? Should Apple be worried about that?
Well, lots of companies come after Apple on patent things. I mean, you know, people come after companies on patents all the time. It's one of those things which is very detailed technically. It's all about various things to do with the wireless systems within it. Nokia's reckoned to want a couple of dollars for each iPhone that's been sold and that will be sold, which could come out to a couple of billion dollars. Apple could certainly pay for that out of its cash reserves, but it's very likely that it will be looking to fight this as far as it can, because it's a lot cheaper to fight it in the courts for a while. I think that the likelihood is that there'll be some sort of deal between Nokia and Apple, or else if Apple can find a patent that Nokia is in some way infringing, then it will. But as we said, Apple doesn't tend to win these patent things. There's been a number down the years, and it often comes out on the wrong end of them.
Mm. Could be a big effect on them. They're looking at charging for every single iPhone sold, by the looks of it.
Yeah, but they have an enormous cash reserve. Apple has so much cash in the bank. Seriously, after its latest financials, it has enough cash sitting in the bank to simply buy Dell outright.
Well, we'll watch out for that then. And now, just before we wrap up the news, we should also briefly mention the fact that Guardian Jobs website was hacked over the weekend. Charles, I believe you've become somewhat of an expert on this. Who's been affected and what should they do about it?
Roughly 500,000 users on the site may have had details compromised. They're still detailing exactly who might have been affected and to what extent they might have been affected. There is a security update page on the Guardian Jobs website. So if you've received an email about this from the Guardian Jobs website, and it's also worth checking your spam folder just in case for some reason it's been put into there, then you should take some action. At the very least, keep an eye on the security update page. If you haven't received an email from the Guardian Jobs website on this matter, then you're not affected. But they are still investigating precisely who has been affected and why, and more details are expected over the next few days.
So there we go. Be vigilant and check your emails. Now, as ever, you can find out more on these stories and others. Check out guardian.co.uk/technology. Which brings us nicely to the next part of the show. It's time for us to take a look at the Guardian blogs and your responses to the week's stories. Charles, who have you heard from?
I rather enjoyed it. We had a post about Google Wave, which was a very detailed explanation of how it works, what you can do, what you can't do, how you stop spam, what the spam problem is, blah, 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 all about Google Wave, which drew a number of comments. But I have to say, I rather like the one from RepoMan70, which said, "So we have Wave, and we also have Cloud. Do we foresee vacuum, fire, earth, and custard? I think people tend to get carried away with these things, a bit like a wave. We're going back to pen and paper. That's so 2010, pads and pens."
That's a whole new game of a rock, paper, scissors by the sound of it.
Vacuum, fire, earth, custard, yeah.
It's brilliant. It's the future. Now, over at the Games blog, Greg Howson wrote about top games designer Peter Molyneux's BAFTA lecture, where he claimed Coronation Street was the most entertaining event of the last 40 years, and gave a short demonstration of Project Natal, which for those with elephant-like memories will remember from last week is Microsoft's gesture-based gaming project. TopScore1234 said, "I'm still totally underwhelmed by Natal. I can't see it being anything other than a gimmick at this stage, and I just don't want to be leaping around my front room or holding an imaginary steering wheel for hours on end. My gaming posture has been hard-coded into me over 30 years, and I can't see myself changing it." While Status Jones simply said, "Cory, the greatest entertainment event of the last 40 years? No!" And I can't help but agree. Now, as always, if you've got a burning question or comment you'd like to put in front of our eyes, drop us a line on Facebook, hit us up on Twitter, or go old school and email us. You'll find links galore on guardian.co.uk/techweekly. And on that subject, I'd like to say thank you to Moxie Park, Mark Leet, The Shark Hunter and Scythor, who all expressed their enjoyment of last week's podcast, as well as to ensure Nick Hyde there will be no more sporting analogies whilst I'm here, and therefore no more references to Jensen Button.
Jensen Button.
So there you have it. All that remains is for me to thank our guests today. Now, next week, you can hear Bobby interviewing Derek Lomas of PlayPower.org, whose aim is to bring 8-bit computing to the third world. There'll be the usual host of other tech lovely delights too. So till next Tuesday, I'm Susie Weezer.